Amarla 15 pantam que nunca haría.
55. 7. The black sun is as big as a couple of football fields laid side by side. The decor consists of black square tabletops hovering in the air. It would be pointless to draw in legs, evenly spaced across the floor in a grid, like pixels. The only exception is in the middle, where the bar's four quadrants come together, 4 = 2². This part is occupied by a circular bar 16 meters across. Everything is matte black, which makes it a lot easier for the computer system to draw things in on top of it. No worries about filling in a complicated background. And that way, all attention can be focused on the avatars, which is the way people like it. It doesn't pay to have a nice avatar on the street, where it's so crowded and all the avatars merge and flow into one another. But the Black Sun is a much classier piece of software. In the Black Sun, avatars are not allowed to collide. Only so many people can be here at once, and they can't walk through each other. Everything is solid and opaque and realistic, and the clientele has a lot more class. No talking penises in here. The avatars look like real people. For the most part, so do the demons. Demon is an old piece of jargon from the Unix operating system, where it referred to a piece of low-level utility software, a fundamental part of the operating system. In the Black Sun, a demon is like an avatar, but it does not represent a human being. It's a robot that lives in the metaverse. A piece of software, a kind of spirit that inhabits the machine, usually with some particular role to carry out. The Black Sun has a number of demons that serve imaginary drinks to the patrons and run little errands for people. It even has bouncer demons that get rid of undesirables, grab their avatars and throw them out the door, applying certain basic principles of avatar physics. David has even enhanced the physics of the Black Sun to make it a little cartoonish so that particularly obnoxious people can be hit over the head with giant mallets or crushed under plummeting safes before they are ejected. This happens to people who are being disruptive, to anyone who is pestering or taping a celebrity, and to anyone who seems contagious. That is, if your personal computer is infected with viruses and attempts to spread them via the Black Sun, you had better keep one eye on the ceiling. Hero mumbles the word, Big Board. This is the name of a piece of software he wrote, a powerful tool for a CIC stringer. It digs into the Black Sun's operating system, rifles it for information, and then throws up a flat square map in front of his face, giving him a quick overview of who's here and whom they're talking to. It's all unauthorized data that Hero is not supposed to have. But Hero is not some bimbo actor coming here to network. He is a hacker. If he wants some information, he steals it right out of the guts of the system. Gossip ex machina. Big Board shows him that David is ensconced in his usual place, a table in the hacker quadrant near the bar. The movie star quadrant has the usual scattering of sovereigns and wannabes. The rock star quadrant is very busy tonight. Hero can see that a Nipponese rap star named Sushi K has stopped in for a visit. And there are a lot of record industry types hanging around in the Nipponese quadrant, which looks like the other quadrants except that it's quieter, the tables are closer to the floor, and it's full of bowing and fluttering geisha demons. Many of these people probably belong to Sushi K's retinue of managers, flacks, and lawyers. Hero cuts across the hacker quadrant, headed for David's table. He recognizes many of the people in here, but as usual, he's surprised and disturbed by the number he doesn't recognize. All those sharp, perceptive 21-year-old faces. Software development, like professional sports, has a way of making 30-year-old men feel decrepit. Looking up the aisle toward David's table, he sees David talking to a black-and-white person. Despite her lack of color and shitty resolution, Hero recognizes her by the way she folds her arms when she's talking, the way she tosses her hair when she's listening to David. Hero's avatar stops moving and stares at her, adopting just the same facial expression with which he used to stare at this woman years ago. In reality, he reaches out with one hand, picks up his beer, takes a pull on the bottle, and lets it roll around in his mouth, a bundle of waves clashing inside a small space. Her name is Juanita Marquez. Hiro has known her ever since they were freshmen together at Berkeley, and they were in the same lab section in a freshman physics class. The first time he saw her, he formed an impression that did not change for many years. She was a dour, bookish, geeky type, who dressed like she was interviewing for a job as an accountant at a funeral parlor. At the same time, she had a flamethrower tongue that she would turn on people at the oddest times, usually in some grandiose, earth-scorching retaliation for a slight or breach of etiquette that none of the other freshmen had even perceived. It wasn't until a number of years later, when they both wound up working at Black Sun Systems, Inc., that he put the other half of the equation together. At the time, both of them were working on avatars. He was working on bodies, she was working on faces. She was the face department, because nobody thought that faces were all that important. They were just flesh-toned busts on top of the avatars. She was just in the process of proving them all desperately wrong. But at this phase, the all-male society of bitheads that made up the power structure of Black Sun Systems said that the face problem was trivial and superficial. It was, of course, nothing more than sexism, the especially virulent type espoused by male techies who sincerely believe that they are too smart to be sexists. That first impression back at the age of 17 was nothing more than that. The gut reaction of a post-adolescent army brat who had been on his own for about 3 weeks. His mind was good, but he only understood one or two things in the whole world. Samurai movies and the Macintosh. And he understood them far, far too well. It was a worldview with no room for someone like Juanita. There's a certain kind of small town that grows like a boil on the ass of every army base in the world. In a long series of such places, hero protagonist was speed-raised like a mutant hothouse orchid, flourishing under the glow of 1,000 buy-and-fly security spotlights. Hero's father had joined the army in 1944 at the age of 16, and spent a year in the Pacific, most of it as a prisoner of war. Hero was born when his father was in his late middle age. By that time, Dad could long since have quit and taken his pension, but he wouldn't have known what to do with himself outside of the service, and so he stayed in until they finally kicked him out in the late 80s. By the time Hero made it out to Berkeley, he had lived in Wrightstown, New Jersey, Tacoma, Washington, Fayetteville, North Carolina, Hinesville, Georgia, Killeen, Texas, Grafenwöhr, Germany, Seoul, Korea, Ogden, Kansas, and Watertown, New York. All of these places were basically the same, with the same franchise ghettos, the same strip joints, and even the same people. He kept running into school chums he'd known years before, other army brats who happened to wind up at the same base at the same time. Their skins were different colors, but they all belonged to the same ethnic group. Military. Black kids didn't talk like black kids. Asian kids didn't bust their asses to excel in school. White kids, by and large, didn't have any problem getting along with the black and Asian kids. And girls knew their place. They all had the same moms, with the same generous buttocks and stretchy slacks, and the same frosted and curling ironed hairdos, and they were all basically sweet and endearing and conforming, and if they happened to be smart, they went out of their way to hide it. So the first time Hiro saw Juanita, or any other girl like her, his perspectives were bent all out of shape. She had long, glossy black hair that had never been subjected to any chemical process other than regular shampooing. She didn't wear blue stuff on her eyelids. Her clothing was dark, tailored, restrained. And she didn't take shit from anyone, not even her professors, which seemed shrewish and threatening to him at the time. When he saw her again after an absence of several years, a period spent mostly in Japan, working among real grown-ups from a higher social class than he was used to, people of substance who wore real clothes and did real things with their lives, he was startled to realize that Juanita was an elegant, stylish knockout. He thought at first that she had undergone some kind of radical changes since their first year in college. But then he went back to visit his father in one of those army towns and ran into the high school prom queen. She had grown up shockingly fast into an overweight dame with loud hair and loud clothes who speed-read the tabloids at the checkout line in the commissary because she didn't have the spare money to buy them, who popped her gum and had two kids that she didn't have the energy or the foresight to discipline. Seeing this woman at the commissary, he finally went through a belated, dim-witted epiphany. Not a brilliant light shining down from heaven, more like the brown glimmer of a half-dead flashlight from the top of a stepladder. Juanita hadn't really changed much at all since those days, just grown into herself. It was he who had changed. Radically. He came into her office once, strictly on a business matter. Until this point, they had seen each other around the office a lot, but acted like they had never met before. But when he came into her office that day, she told him to close the door behind him, and she blacked out the screen on her computer and started twiddling a pencil between her hands and eyed him like a plate of day-old sushi. Behind her on the wall was an amateurish painting of an old lady, set in an ornate antique frame. It was the only decoration in Juanita's office. All the other hackers had color photographs of the space shuttle lifting off, or posters of the Starship Enterprise. "It's my late grandmother, may God have mercy on her soul," she said, watching him look at the painting. "My role model."
Why, was she a programmer?
She just looked at him over the rotating pencil like, how slow can a mammal be and still have respiratory functions? But instead of lowering the boom on him, she just gave a simple answer. "No." Then she gave a more complicated answer. "When I was 15 years old, I missed a period. My boyfriend and I were using a diaphragm, but I knew it was fallible. I was good at math. I had the failure rate memorized, burnt into my subconscious. Or maybe it was my conscious. I can never keep them straight. Anyway, I was terrified. Our family dog started treating me differently. Supposedly, they can smell a pregnant woman. Or a pregnant bitch, for that matter." By this point, Hiro's face was frozen in a wary, astonished position that Juanita later made extensive use of in her work. Because as she was talking to him, she was watching his face, analyzing the way the little muscles in his forehead pulled his brows up and made his eyes change shape. "My mother was clueless. My boyfriend was worse than clueless. In fact, I ditched him on the spot because it made me realize what an alien the guy was, like many members of your species." By this, she was referring to males. "Anyway, my grandmother came to visit," she continued, glancing back over her shoulder at the painting. "I avoided her until we all sat down for dinner, and then she figured out the whole situation in maybe 10 minutes, just by watching my face across the dinner table. I didn't say more than 10 words. Pass the tortillas. I don't know how my face conveyed that information, or what kind of internal wiring in my grandmother's mind enabled her to accomplish this incredible feat, to condense fact from the vapor of nuance." Condense fact from the vapor of nuance. Hiro has never forgotten the sound of her speaking those words. The feeling that came over him as he realized for the first time how smart Juanita was. She continued, "I didn't even really appreciate all of this until about 10 years later as a grad student, trying to build a user interface that would convey a lot of data very quickly for one of these baby killer grants." This was her term for anything related to the Defense Department. "I was coming up with all kinds of elaborate technical fixes, like trying to implant electrodes directly into the brain. Then I remembered my grandmother and realized, my God, the human mind can absorb and process an incredible amount of information if it comes in the right format, the right interface, if you put the right face on it. Want some coffee?" Then he had an alarming thought. What had he been like back in college? How much of an asshole had he been? Had he left Juanita with a bad impression? Another young man would have worried about it in silence, but Hiro has never been restrained by thinking about things too hard, and so he asked her out for dinner and, after having a couple of drinks, she drank club sodas, just popped the question. "Do you think I'm an asshole?" She laughed. He smiled, believing that he had come up with a good, endearing, flirtatious bit of patter. He did not realize until a couple of years later that this question was, in effect, the cornerstone of their relationship. Did Juanita think that Hiro was an asshole? He always had some reason to think that the answer was yes, but 9 times out of 10 she insisted the answer was no. It made for some great arguments and some great sex, some dramatic fallings out and some passionate reconciliations. But in the end, the wildness was just too much for them. They were exhausted by work, and they backed away from each other. He was emotionally worn out from wondering what she really thought of him, and confused by the fact that he cared so deeply about her opinion. And she, maybe, was beginning to think that if Hiro was so convinced in his own mind that he was unworthy of her, maybe he knew something she didn't. Hiro would have chalked it all up to class differences, except that her parents lived in a house in Mexicali with a dirt floor, and his father made more money than many college professors. But the class idea still held sway in his mind, because class is more than income. It has to do with knowing where you stand in a web of social relationships. Juanita and her folks knew where they stood with a certitude that bordered on dementia. Hiro never knew. His father was a sergeant major. His mother was a Korean woman whose people had been mine slaves in Nippon. And Hiro didn't know whether he was black or Asian or just plain army. Whether he was rich or poor, educated or ignorant, talented or lucky. He didn't even have a part of the country to call home until he moved to California, which is about as specific as saying that you live in the Northern Hemisphere. In the end, it was probably his general disorientation that did them in. After the breakup, Hiro went out with a long succession of essentially bimbos who, unlike Juanita, were impressed that he worked for a high-tech Silicon Valley firm. More recently, he has had to go searching for women who are even easier to impress. Juanita went celibate for a while and then started going out with David and eventually got married to him. David had no doubts whatsoever about his standing in the world. His folks were Russian Jews from Brooklyn and had lived in the same brownstone for 70 years after coming from a village in Latvia, where they had lived for 500 years. With the Torah on his lap, he could trace his bloodlines all the way back to Adam and Eve. He was an only child who had always been first in his class in everything. And when he got his master's in computer science from Stanford, he went out and started his own company with about as much fuss as Hiro's dad used to exhibit in renting out a new P.O. box when they moved. Then he got rich, and now he runs the Black Sun. David has always been certain of everything, even when he's totally wrong. Which is why Hiro quit his job at Black Sun Systems, despite the promise of future riches, and why Juanita divorced David 2 years after she married him. Hiro did not attend Juanita and David's wedding. He was languishing in jail, into which he had been thrown a few hours before the rehearsal. He had been found in Golden Gate Park, lovesick, wearing nothing but a thong, taking long pulls from a jumbo bottle of Courvoisier, and practicing kendo attacks with a genuine samurai sword, floating across the grass on powerfully muscled thighs to slice other picnickers' frisbees and baseballs in twain. Catching a long fly ball with the edge of your blade, neatly halving it like a grapefruit, is not an insignificant feat. The only drawback is that the owners of the baseball may misinterpret your intentions and summon the police. He got out of it by paying for all the baseballs and frisbees. But since that episode, he has never even bothered to ask Juanita whether or not she thinks he's an asshole. Even Hiro knows the answer now. Since then, they've gone very different ways. In the early years of the Black Sun Project, the only way the hackers ever got paid was by issuing stock to themselves. Hiro tended to sell his off almost as quickly as he got it. Juanita didn't. Now she's rich, and he isn't. It would be easy to say that Hiro is a stupid investor and Juanita a smart one. But the facts are a little more complicated than that. Juanita put her eggs in one basket, keeping all her money in Black Sun stock. As it turns out, she made a lot of money that way, but she could have gone broke, too. And Hiro didn't have a lot of choice in some ways. When his father got sick, the Army and the VA took care of most of his medical bills, but they ran into a lot of expenses anyway. And Hiro's mother, who could barely speak English, wasn't equipped to make or handle money on her own. When Hiro's father died, he cashed in all of his Black Sun stock to put Mom in a nice community in Korea. She loves it there, goes golfing every day. He could have kept his money in the Black Sun and made $10 million about a year later when it went public, but his mother would have been a street person. So when his mother visits him in the metaverse, looking tan and happy in her golfing duds, Hiro views that as his personal fortune. It won't pay the rent, but that's okay. When you live in a shithole, there's always the metaverse. And in the metaverse, Hiro Protagonist is a warrior prince.